for coming. My name is David Marar. I am the 2016 Google Policy Fellow at the Internet Education Foundation. I wanted to welcome you guys to our second event in the series we're calling The Snowden Effect. Our first event was 2 weeks ago, and it was on data localization at Microsoft. We have audio up on the website at stateofthenet.org if you're interested. Now, this event is obviously on transparency, trust, and subpoenas, and you know that's been in the news lately. So I think it's going to be an interesting panel. I just wanted to also announced that we are now partnering with the media organization Vocative for our Snowden Effects event series. They're going to be live tweeting our last event, which is on government surveillance, and also one of their journalists is going to be moderating the event. So a lot of things happening. Thank you very much for coming. I'm gonna throw it away to our lovely host, Miranda Bogan. There you go.
Thanks, David. My name is Miranda Bogan, and I'm a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, which is the sponsor of this instance of the Snowden Effect series, together with OTI at New America. This is very loud.
I'll try my mic. That can be better.
Yeah, okay. A brief word on the Foundry. We're a young professional organization for early career technology policy and law professionals who are really passionate about how technology is changing the law, changing how policy is created, and in both the government context, the private sector context, firm context, very broadly. All sorts of different topic areas, and so we have fellows who create programming throughout the year on different topics that we're interested in. And so we are lucky to have two of us who are fellows in the Foundry today. Liz Woolery is over at OTI working on transparency, and we also have David from Google to tell us a little bit about the private sector perspective, especially as we're talking about transparency, government requests, what type of data is being collected and requested and shared. As David mentioned, the impetus for this conversation is what impact did the Snowden revelations have on how users of technology services understand the information that they're creating, and when is that provided to law enforcement or national security, the national security apparatus, and also how do companies react to those requests? How have they had to change their behavior, or have they felt that they ought to change their behavior in light of those revelations? And what does this ecosystem of trust and transparency look like, and what does the future look like? So I wanted to just start with some of the basics. There are a lot of different types of government requests for data, and some of them are a bit obscure and technical. What are the different types of data that companies get requested for, and what are the sort of legal constructs that lead to that?
Sure. Yeah, so we get a range of requests, and I'll try to give sort of a brief overview of how they work, from subpoenas to wiretaps. So the subpoenas are basically directives or orders we receive from a governmental entity to disclose certain types of data. It's basic subscriber information that you might provide, for example, when you start or establish a Google account. And there is no independent court review for these types of requests. They're issued by governmental entities to companies like Google. But as a result, there's only a narrow range of what's at least perceived to be less sensitive information that we can disclose. And then the next step is what's often referred to under the Stored Communications Act as a 2703D order. So this does require some judicial review for the records and information that are sought by a governmental entity. Government has to provide specific and articulable facts to demonstrate that the requested information is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. So there's a higher standard for these types of records. And just an example of what you might think of as the type of records that are subject to a 2703D order, it's to/from information on an email, or it could be an IP address that's associated with a specific action. For example, a login to an account at a particular time, or the sending of an email at a particular time, the IP address that's associated with it. And then warrants. which require the government to show that there's probable cause to believe that contraband or certain information that pertains to a crime is to be found in the particular place to be searched. So for the universe of information that can be attained with a warrant includes everything that is subject to a 2703D order. It also includes any information that you can get with a subpoena, but then also gets to the content of communications, including the body of a Gmail, for example, or a YouTube video, photos, things of that nature that, that pertain sort of to the substance, as it's defined, the substance, import, or meaning of a communication. And then we have wiretaps too, and those are often sort of called super warrants because they require additional protections beyond what is just required for stored content. The government has to show that they've exhausted other ways to obtain the information. They have to minimize the information. The sort of common example that is seen less and less these days as a result of the growth of the internet, the decline of the telephone, is the van that's outside of the building with the government agents sort of listening in, and then having to sort of check off when the conversation shifts to sort of unrelated information about the criminal investigation. I think, you know, there are also time limits too for wiretaps, which are the collection of contents in real time. Pen registers and trap and trace requests. This is really for the capturing of real time addressing and routing information, information about a communication, but not the communication itself. And then just a couple of more, we get emergency disclosure requests. Under the Stored Communications Act, companies like Google are authorized to, but not required, to disclose the contents of communication when there is an emergency request that involves a serious risk of bodily injury or death. So that's been the discussion of some ongoing debate in the context of ECPA reform. And then finally, preservation requests. These are not actually requests for user data, but it's effectively a request to freeze an account at a particular time because the government is going to be obtaining legal process and wants to maintain that account intact while they do so. Oftentimes, this happens when there's a fear of destruction or loss of evidence in the time between the issuance of the preservation request and the time that the governmental entity takes to obtain the legal process. But if you see in our transparency report, and we released the latest update to this yesterday, we do receive quite a few, thousands of these requests on a six-month basis. So it's not unusual for us to get them, but it doesn't require the actual production of user data.
Now, we'll talk about transparency reports in a little bit, and Liz has done a lot of work into looking into the different ways that companies portray the different requests that they receive. But it does seem like different companies do approach requests slightly differently. Is there any room for discretion in what type of metadata is included in the court order, or is it pretty cut and dry in terms of the type of process that's served and under which law?
That's a good question. I think I think the challenge that you're sort of alluding to is one that is presented as a result of the fact that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, I'm going to say ECPA from here on out, is a 30-year-old statute that has that is in desperate need of updating. And so when I was talking about the 2703D order, that applies to records and other information, which is left undefined. We have an idea of what basic subscriber information is under ECPA. We have an idea about what content is. The communications metadata that falls in between isn't clear. And so companies do take different, some companies may take different views about what constitutes content versus non-content. I think we've erred on the side of including within the realm of content material that maybe arguably others would perceive as non-content, either data that's subject to a 2703D order or data that's subject, for example, to just sort of a subpoena under basic subscriber information. But I think that's why you see in some respects, you see some litigation around, for example, location information, whether there ought to be different legal standards for the collection of that information, depending on how precise it is, whether it's collected retrospectively, meaning it's already been collected and you're trying to obtain it, or whether it's being collected on a prospective basis.
Yeah. And you know, this is particularly relevant these days because if I'm understanding correctly, the telecommunications providers have slightly different frameworks in which they operate. But today you have services like WhatsApp and Signal and things that kind of resemble the services that you think are telecommunication services, text messages, but are really more similar to technology services. And so, you know, where do the text message metadata, where does that fall? Like, is that something that Google's thinking about in terms of dividing their services, or is it all kind of under one umbrella?
Yeah, I think we sort of examine those sort of questions on a product or product by product or service by service basis. And so, you know, traditional telecom providers are subject to the communication, what's called the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act. And there's been some discussions recently, I think, in light of litigation involving Apple and the federal government about the scope of what exactly CALEA requires and also you know, other statutory regimes and what those require as well. But I think traditionally the requests that we received have fallen under ECBA. When we've entered into new lines of business, there are some obligations that we have under CALEA, particularly in the sort of broad provisioning of broadband internet access. So it really just does vary depending on the type of request we get and the service or product, you know, for which it applies.
So I want to turn to Liz because, you know, as you can tell from the first few minutes of this conversation, there's a lot of technical detail in these types of decisions that, you know, users of these services probably don't fully grasp, but they still have an interest in knowing, you know, is their data being shared? And so companies have moved towards producing transparency reports. Now, Liz, can you tell us about the history of this trend, what these reports include, and how did they come about?
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say is transparency reports, I believe Google actually had the first transparency report in 2010. And so this is pre-Snowden, and pre-Snowden there are only a handful of companies of internet telcos that are interested in or engaging in the practice of publishing a transparency report. I think LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter were early adopters. Snowden happens in 2013, and it signifies this huge concern about a loss of public trust. And in response to that, and sometimes almost in immediate response to that, companies started publishing transparency reports in which they would detail this information about the types of requests they get for customer information. Interestingly, the reports actually often include a lot of information that is not related to government data requests. You'll see information about intellectual property and DMCA takedowns, information about government requests to remove content or have an account deactivated, and search and preservation requests, and Google's got some cool features in their report where they're showing encrypted traffic and a few other things. So we're starting to see transparency reports go beyond the scope of just government data requests. But kind of back to your original question, it really was Snowden that sparked this big flood of transparency reports. Pre-Snowden, we have a handful of companies that are reporting. Post-Snowden, now, we have, in the United States, probably a little more than 50 companies that are engaged in the practice. And then there are probably a couple of dozen outside of the United States that are publishing transparency reports. And the reports are much more popular here in the US than abroad. There are just fewer companies abroad that are kind of taking up this practice, and that could be for a number of reasons. But there are some major companies like Vodafone, Deutsche Telekom, that are publishing really kind of interesting, innovative transparency reports too.
And that's an entirely voluntary process, right? You know, they're just opting in.
Yeah, but both here and abroad, it's going to be entirely voluntary. There have been discussions, I believe in Canada, for example, about what mandated reporting might look like. I am of the view that mandated reporting is not a good idea.
Why?
One of the great things about transparency reporting and the way that it's evolved is that as companies took up the practice, they were able to see what their peers or what their competitors were doing. And so they kind of iterated and they began to innovate in their reports as well. So we start to see reports from different companies that have different features that are reporting more granularly or that are involving interactive graphics. I fear one thing I fear with mandated reporting is that it would kind of cut back on that innovation. And I also worry that if we were to have, say, government mandated reporting, that there would be constraints on what could be reported.
Yeah, I'm curious now, are there constraints on what can be reported? How much can be reported?
Yeah, I mean, and David can address some of these questions too, but the biggest one, the one we kind of hear most about, would be the limits on what companies can say about national security orders, national security letters, and FISA orders. And oftentimes, those are going to come with basically a gag order that says the companies can't acknowledge the existence of the order. There can also be orders like a subpoena that will come with an order that the company can't notify the user about it. So there are certain limits on what they can and can't acknowledge publicly or to the users.
Yeah, David, can you shed some more light on that? And also interested in hearing a little bit about the evolution of Google's transparency report.
Yeah, and there have been significant constraints, I think, that have been placed on service providers to disclose information about national security requests that we receive. And you look back even in the beginning of 2013, and companies couldn't disclose even in ranges the number of national security letters that they receive, couldn't say anything about demands that they receive under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And so folks look at our transparency reports, and ours was updated just yesterday, and they see these ranges for national security letters, and they see the ranges for certain types of FISA demands. And you know, I think there's some fair criticism to be made about the fact that this isn't quite enough.